Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, for the first time as governor, Kim Reynolds is with us, joining us for the entire first hour by phone. Governor Reynolds, how nice you could join us.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to do it.
You've been in office now 5 months. We want to get a few reflections there. Also, you look forward. I want to reach out to our listeners. We have quite a bit of a stockpile of questions on our Facebook page. We hope to move along and get to as many of those as possible in about a half dozen areas. But I'll throw out our telephone number as well. If you'd like to ask Governor Reynolds a question, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about your priorities, first of all. I understand recently you met with members of Iowa's congressional delegation to discuss state and federal legislative priorities. What are the main highlights you see working together on there?
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank them for the work with the renewable fuel standard. That was a collaborative effort, I think, to really highlight the importance of a robust renewable fuel standard and the impact that that has on Iowa farmers and our rural economy in the state, especially with depressed commodity prices. And so it was an opportunity to thank them for that and for, you know, their work on health care with the collapse of our individual health care market and the impact of Obamacare, and what we're facing with the individual market. We'd worked closely with them as we tried to put in place a waiver that would help provide, you know, an opportunity for 72,000 Iowans come January 1 to have access to health care. So we talked a little bit about that and the short-term policies that President Trump did through the executive order, as well as the association plan, and kind of how we can maybe move forward with that with an expedited rulemaking process. And then, again, just highlighted our top four priorities. Of course, we're hoping to get something. I'd like to get a water quality bill on my desk. I'm hoping that can be one of the first bills I get to sign as the governor of the state of Iowa. And then as we, you know, the four priorities really build on the past as we work to build a brighter future for Iowans. And as one of the things that we need to do, I think, is to make sure to be competitive, that we have a competitive business environment. And that, of course, means tax reform as well, and making it simpler, flatter, more competitive. In addition to that, it also means making sure that we have connectivity across the state. If we want young people to stay in rural Iowa, we need to make sure that they can connect to the world, because that's the expectation. And really, we've seen great examples where the connectivity is there, that individuals in like Bellevue, Iowa, can couple that started a small company and really has turned it into a robust business selling Time is the name of the company, selling curling irons and hair blowers to 40 countries around the world, and she only sells those online. Making sure that we have the most innovative energy policy in the country. Well, we want to continue to lead in the renewable fuel industry. We're proud of our leadership role in the ethanol and biodiesel, cellulosic, and wind.
Just to jump in there on the renewable fuel standard, is that decided?
Yeah.
Is that decided? Have we come out with the previous standard?
Well, I don't think, you know, they'll make their final decision at the end of November, as I believe when EPA will make their final decision. So, but I was able to talk to President Trump as well as Administrator Pruitt, and I was able to meet with him last week when I was in D.C., as well as the congressional delegation, to just, you know, continue to push for, you know, really abiding by the intent of a robust renewable fuel standard, which is to grow the biofuels industry and to drive innovation. And so it was a very productive meeting again with him last week. And so, but, you know, we have to continue to fight for it every single day, especially when you take a look at the impact that that has on Iowa. And so this is about, you know, energy independence. It's about choice at the pump. It's about really a robust economy in rural Iowa and providing options for, we continue, farmers do what they do best, and they produce, and yields are going to continue to be bigger on a smaller footprint. And so we want to make sure that we're not only looking for additional markets, but we're looking for ways that we can add value to the products and commodities that our farmers make. And so we, you know, even when it's settled in November, we go to work for the next go around. So we're constantly talking about how important it is and that we can meet the expectations. If they set the volumes at the at a high level, we will and can in this country meet the expectations. So we had a good conversation about that. But so we have to continue to fight for it.
Okay, Governor Reynolds, we have, as I said, a number of listener questions here. We want to get in as many as possible. But first, I feel I have to ask you about the news out of Washington in the last 24 hours. Two indictments, a guilty plea. Have these indictments, the guilty plea, changed your view or your support for this administration in any way? You have been an enthusiastic Trump supporter.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think, you know, we need to let the process, the legal process, play out, and that's what it's doing. And I think the first one with Manafort was years before he'd ever been involved in the campaign. But so we just need to, if we need to let the legal process work, and so we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, I just ticked off four or five meetings that I've been able to have. And so I am with not only the White House, but with the cabinet, and we have had unprecedented access to this administration. They have weighed in, they have asked governors, they have asked us what we can do to work collectively together, and I am grateful. We spent so much time with the previous administration filing lawsuits and fighting against them. To have a partner in the White House is second to none, and so I appreciate the accessibility. I appreciate the fact they're working with us, and that I can, you know, pick up the phone or have Administrator Pruitt call or get a call with the president or Purdue. I mean,
back to the Russia investigation, the latest revelations. The president still maintains it's nothing more than a witch hunt based on a hoax invented by Democrats and the news media. Is that your view? Does that in any way reflect your view that it's a hoax and a witch hunt?
Well, what I just said is we need the process to weigh out. I'm not going to get in the middle of it. I'm not going to speculate. He's indicated that he has had nothing to do with that. And so, you know, I'm going to take him at his word and tell, but we're going to, the process has to pay out. I'm not going to speculate what the findings are. That's why Congress has the, they can ensure that they have the oversight so that it doesn't overstep its bounds. So there's a check and balance in place, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, Governor Reynolds, let's go to our first caller. John is in Iowa City. Hi, John. We have a number of callers and Facebook questions, so I'll ask you to chip in your question. Please be brief and concise. Thanks, John. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'd like to ask the governor, what would you say to someone that currently does not have health insurance or would lose coverage if the Affordable Care Act is repealed?
Yeah, well, I've talked to a lot of families as I travel across the state, and I've been saying this for 3 years. I have been saying that Obamacare is unaffordable, unsustainable, and unworkable, and have been trying to figure out a solution. We had a robust individual market where we had, a low number of uninsured. We had a robust market. We had some of the lowest premiums in the country. And over the last 4 years, we've seen the premiums increase 110%. We had 9 healthcare providers when we started, and before we went into Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And right now, we have one carrier left in the individual market, and there's no competition. And the one carrier has escalated premiums by 57%. So I it's horrible. I'm working every day to try to find at least some type of a solution for the 72,000 Iowans that potentially might not have access to health care. Because you know who that is? That's hardworking Iowans, that's farmers, that's small business owners that are trying to take an idea and grow a business into a successful company, and they're being hamstringed by the cost of health care and insurance. So what's happened is, I ultimately need the federal government to do something because they've taken the flexibility and state rights away when we went to Obamacare. We put together a 1332 waiver, and it doesn't have. It was creative and it was innovative, it would have helped with the people that were trying to help, and we were told that it didn't meet the guidelines.
Okay. So, that's news from a few days ago. John, I think the essence of his question is, what do you have to say to a person who will lose insurance? What are your words, person to person?
Yeah, so first of all, I understand how devastating it is and the uncertainty that it causes. I've been saying this for 3 years. So we're working every day to continue. When I met with the congressional delegation, if you heard me earlier, the president did through executive order talk about maybe making short-term plans available. And so These were already in place. I think right before the previous administration stepped out, you used to be able to buy them for like just shy of a year. He reduced that to just for 3 months. So we're hoping that they can go back to the previous rule and expedite the rule. So shortly after January, we'll have some type of an option. But bottom line, I need Congress to do their job. I need them to repeal and replace so that we can help. And Iowa is not alone. Nebraska is the same. There are states all across the country that are facing the same thing that we are because of the requirements that placed on the individual market. And you've got, carriers are pulling out. We had 9 healthcare providers, 9 in our individual market. And today we have 1. And when I started the waiver process to figure out something, we asked for emergency rules because at that point, when I started, all of them had pulled out. We have a collapsing market. We had nobody in the market at all. And so this was an alternative. I think it was we worked with Wellmark. We worked with the insurance commissioner. And, I think it was a good product, but it was a short-term fix. I always approached it from that perspective. It was not a long-term fix. We still need Congress to do something, but it would have provided an option. What it would have done is brought healthy individuals back into the individual market. It would have stabilized the individual market for the short term and helped make it more affordable. It would have reduced the premiums by, I think it was about 35% compared to the 57% increase that we're seeing with Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. Governor Reynolds, another healthcare question. I understand you visited several treatment centers last week for opioid awareness week. And here's a question specifically from one of our listeners on our Facebook page. Chuck Eisenhart asks, what bills do you want to sign to tackle Iowa's opioid public health emergency? Any of those that a majority of other states have already passed?
Well, we look forward to working in a bipartisan manner. This isn't a Republican or a Democrat issue. This is an issue that's a crisis in states across this country. And so it was a really, really good awareness week. We did 4 stops. We had a great conference at Drake University. We took a look at really highlighting, the work that's already being done so we can continue to empower and build capacity for the good things that are being done. Dubuque is a great example. Mercy Turning Point, the collaboration, coordination that they're providing, it's a great, great model. And, they really have the structure in place. They have a great team and passion, and they have the leadership to really do some positive things. Medication-assisted treatment was one of the areas that they were looking at. So that was a great example. Then we visited Van Buren County, who has a really great collaborative effort with the University of Iowa, where they have virtual hospitalist service. And so, again, using technology and the virtual hospitalist service, they're able to do some great things through telemedicine. That's what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then really help those who need it. So influence improvement. So some of the things we're looking at, and we need to work with the legislature, is to expand the prescription monitoring program. Right now, there's less than half of the prescribers that are using it. We need to automate the system and do some. It's very cumbersome right now, but they're working on that. So that's an area that we can really, I think, help drive. We want to take a look at working with the legislature to reduce the opioid prescribing to prevent misuse. So that's something I think Attorney General Miller was at he spoke at the conference at Drake, too, and we did the press conference afterwards, and I know this is something that he's very interested in. Enhanced interventions. So, we did a standing order for naloxone, so we want to take a look at seeing if we can maybe do more with expanding, programs like that. Good Samaritan law, something I want to take a look at with the legislature. 36 other states have enacted that. And
you expect there to be a bill with several bills that will address the opioid crisis also here in Iowa in this session.
Well, and I don't know if part of that stuff doesn't even take legislation. So we need to take a look. This was a kind of a fact gathering. It was an opportunity to see what's going on. It was an opportunity to look for ways that we can enhance and build capacity with some of the good programs and then see if there's some barriers and some things that we need to address. I think the conference, we had just a really good showing of stakeholders, all that are involved in helping address this issue. And so there were some good things that come out of that. So not everything requires legislation, but we need to take a look at if there is something, the number of prescriptions provided or being used, that may, the Good Samaritan would, but not everything that we're talking about. There's opportunities for us to enhance existing programs, maybe without legislation. So we'll look at everything and work with the legislature, because they actually have been meeting on this also. And so I'm sure they've got some things that, you know, that they want to take a look at. And so I think this is a great opportunity to look for some areas just together, how we can really collaborate and make a difference.
Here's some news probably not new to you, but to us here. Iowa's DHS will be holding a press conference today about the Medicaid managed care. Do you know what the message will be in that press conference about managed care here in the state?
Well, Jerry has been working with the managed care providers, so I'm not going to get in front of the press conference. But so he's been working the last several months to negotiate the contracts, where he's really trying to make sure that we have a sustainable program and we can help provide the services for some of the most vulnerable Iowans in the state, as well as make sure that we're, you know, also being mindful of taxpayer dollars and being responsible in how we provide the services. So it's probably in regards to that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this trade question from our listener, Jennifer. Given that Trump, she writes, withdrew from the TPP despite opposition from the American Farm Bureau Federation, given that Trump has threatened to withdraw from the North America Free Trade Agreement, despite the widespread consensus, this would be terrible for farmers. Do you believe that the president's policies are good for rural Iowans?
I made it clear, I support the president, but that doesn't mean that we agree on every aspect or everything that he does. I've been a strong supporter of the TPP when I was serving as the lieutenant governor, worked extensively with our commodity groups and our manufacturers, talking about, especially when we talk about NAFTA, looking for ways that we can modernize the language. I think there's an opportunity there. It's a 23-year-old trade agreement, and I believe Mexico and Canada believe that there are opportunities to modernize the agreement. You know, there are one and two trade partners, our largest export markets, and so we are very mindful of that. One in five jobs in Iowa is attributed to our ability to export our goods. In fact, I think it's about 63% of jobs attributed to exports actually are tied to manufacturing, which is actually tied to agriculture. So it's an extremely important.
And you've lobbied the president to keep these trade agreements.
I have. Yeah, I've said, I refer to him as modernizing it. I've talked to Secretary Perdue. He's a former governor. He's been really, I think, instrumental in talking about the importance of that. I mean, it needs to be free and it needs to be fair. So I think that it does need to be looked at, but it's also, especially for ag, because we're at a surplus when we look at the trade, with especially Canada and Mexico. And so we use that as an example of how to really, when you're renegotiating, this is a great example of how it can be done right. But I just met with Vice President Pence last week, and actually U.S. Trade Representative Lighthizer. And I talked about how devastating this would be to Iowa farmers and our manufacturers, especially, again, with depressed commodity prices, very volatile economy in the Midwest and in Iowa, and reiterated the importance of just modernizing and not pulling out. And as I travel the state, there's been a lot of, I think, anxiety and angst, and I've noticed that tick up a little bit in the last 3 weeks, and I wanted to relay that to them. We need to bring some stability to the markets, and we need to continue to look for not only maintaining our existing market share, but look for new opportunities as well. It's why we lead a trade mission every year. So I reiterated my concerns to Vice President Pence, as well as U.S. Trade Representative, I think, Ambassador Lighthizer, as well. And the congressional delegation is there, too. So We're all working very, very closely with that, all members of our delegation.
We have just a couple minutes left, Governor. I have to ask you about this. We had so many questions on our Facebook page. Also, I see that your words from a few days ago even inspired a ray gun T-shirt. I don't know if you've seen the T-shirt, but I think you know what I'm referring to. At a recent GOP fundraiser, you said this.
As we all know, as we travel the state, the liberals are unhinged, and they are out for us. And we need to double down and do all we can. And if you keep fighting, I'll keep fighting. Let's keep this united team together because, my gosh, we want to build on the successes that we've seen this last legislative session. And we want to keep Iowa moving forward. We don't want them to come in and reverse the good work that we've done.
Okay, that was at the Harvest Festival in Des Moines.
Yeah.
What did you mean by unhinged? It has unhinged to some of our listeners, and I'm sure it's gotten back to you to use that word on, well, what is a lot of Iowans.
Okay, well, I'll give you one example. So, you know, I'm the governor of all Iowans, and even people that disagree with me. So that statement is probably, it was a broad statement, and it's about probably a very narrow group of individuals. But I want to give you an example. So, and as my social media account, I'm a grandmother of nine. I have nine grandchildren. And I have a personal account as well as the official account. And, you know, my family is very important to me. I make time for them and have because they're a big part of who I am and what I do. And I was at my grandson's soccer game. And this is a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old playing soccer. And as a grandma, I posted a picture of the two of them on my private account, saying what a fun day it was to watch the two of them playing soccer. And the comments that were put on that post were unbelievable. And
right.
I'm the governor, and I'm tough, and I know what I signed up for, but my family did not. And basically, I'm poisoning the water, and I hope it kills your grandparents here for your children.
Right.
And that is over the top.
Exactly.
One small example. These children.
But you said liberals in the state are unhinged. You cast that aspersion on all liberals in the state. I guess that's the gripe.
Well, here you go. Here, I'm giving you an example, and that is one example. One small example. Now, come after me. That's fine. But the discourse in this country has got to stop. We need to be able to.
Right. But you use the word unhinged. Does that help the discourse when you use a partisan unhinged?
When they're attacking my grandchildren, that to me is over the top. Mm-hmm. I had my daughter call and say, you know, what, did you know this person? Take that down, Mom. This is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
What do you think? Yeah. Well, do you think that's unhinged? Do you think that's over the top?
Well, that particular comment is completely uncalled for. We've run out of time. We want to thank you so much, Governor Reynolds, for joining us.
Well, it is over the top. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. When we come back to mark All Hallows Eve, we'll explore haunted houses and the science of fear with the University of Iowa brain scientist and neurologist Daniel Trunell. When we come back, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What happens in your brain? Happy Halloween, by the way. What happens in your brain, though, when you experience fear or you get a real good fright? And how has our understanding of the way our body experiences fear changed over time? Well, to mark Halloween, we'll want to explore these and other questions about the nature of fear with Dr. Daniel Trunell. He's a professor of neurology and brain sciences at the University of Iowa. Also, Kelsey Spaulding, a fifth-year doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at the UI, studies fear generalization. Dr. Trunell and Kelsey Spaulding, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. Glad to be here. Happy Halloween. I'm dressed as a brain scientist here, as you can see.
Ian Miller is with us as well. He's in our Des Moines studio, owner and operator of Slaughterhouse. Is it The Slaughterhouse or just Slaughterhouse, Ian?
Hi, Ben. Happy Halloween. It is The Slaughterhouse.
The Slaughterhouse. And this is a haunted house, or how do you like to describe it?
We are the new premier haunted attraction in central Iowa.
Okay, haunted attraction. There we go. Let's start out with your haunted attraction. And when people pay, how much do they pay, by the way?
Our general admission cost is $20. That means you got to stand in a line.
Wow, I better get frightened. Okay, all right. What do I get for my $20? What happens to me?
So we've got an average of 20-minute experience inside the attraction, but it really starts when you enter the gates. So you come through the gates, you purchase your ticket, and you stand in the queue where several line actors are gathered around, and they perform all sorts of antics, which get you in the spirit and prepare your mind for the battle within the attraction.
Okay, once you get in, what I know, without giving it away, of course, the essence of fright is to be surprised by something truly awful. But what can you tell us about what you're particularly proud of this year in reaching your goal of giving patrons a real fright?
So obviously, the audience's perspective changes over time, and in our modern world, most people are desensitized to a great degree. So while it is important to create a great startle in the dark and show the things that people would expect to horrify them, it's also, and more critical in my mind, to create an extremely immersive environment that encapsulates, you know, the lead-up to that moment of fear. So we do our best to create an extremely immersive atmosphere leading up to each startle.
You want people to have really jangly nerves in a short amount of time. You do this with what? Sounds as well, I bet.
Everything from sound to smell, touch.
Are there things touching me when I go in?
Props sometimes will touch the patrons. Our actors are not allowed to. However, our actors do handle props from time to time as well. So
Okay. And you've been doing this how many years?
This was actually the fifth season of operation for the Slaughterhouse. We did go dark, no pun intended, for 3 years between 2013 and our new rebirthing year this year.
Okay. Before we get to our fear scientists here, I imagine one of the worries or the concerns that you have is you have to walk a line. You have to be safe. But you have to give people the feeling they're not safe. How do you do that?
It's a conversation that we have ongoing throughout the season and leading up to the season. It's a difficult line to walk. I mean, we have joked about actually putting a sign on the front of our ticket trailer that says hashtag trigger warning, because the entire place is one in this in this modern day and age.
Do you have a warnings when you go in? Because there are people, you know, you would think they would know this themselves. If you have a heart condition, you don't go into one of these places, right? But do you have any specific language that is a disclaimer or?
We do. It's everywhere. It's on the site. It's on the back of the ticket. It's on several placards when you walk up to the attraction and actually inside the beginning of the attraction.
And it says?
It has a warning about the fact that we use theatrical lighting, strobes, fog, things of that matter. We also warn them against any loose articles and, of course, any property that they might be holding. We warn against any use of drugs and alcohol before entering. We warn against, of course, carrying any kind of weapons or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm. What's the most terrified you've seen one of your patrons? Describe that person.
Yeah, for those of you that don't believe in the paranormal, levitation is a very possible effect. I've seen individuals basically levitate through a room. They're so scared they bounce off the wall like a pinball. But some of the other effects that happen are vomiting, wetting of pants, and defecation.
Wow, and does that tell you you've reached your goal or not reached your goal?
We do have a leather belt that we notch.
Okay. Join our conversation, Ian Miller, owner and operator of the Slaughterhouse in Des Moines, a haunted attraction. Open, of course, this time of year. Dr. Daniel Trunell, a neuropsychologist with us, along with graduate student Kelsey Spaulding, who does work in fear science. Dr. Trunell, so from what we gather of this description of the Slaughterhouse in Des Moines, what is happening in terms of brain science, people going to the Slaughterhouse from a mild scare to what he just described, where I'm sure people did not mean to pay for that result?
Yeah, it was $20 they're paying for that result.
We do offer a diaper at the trailer if they need.
Yeah, so fear is a very basic emotion that's hardwired into us right from the start. It's an extremely important emotion for survival, and we implement that emotion in our bodies and in our brains using a lot of the basic primitive parts of the brain that are set up to deal with, survival and to deal with the appropriate responses to fearful stimuli, sudden loud noises, things like the visual cliff or the appearance that you're about to fall off of the edge of something are very basic responses that occur in very young children in the first year of life. And then fear of things like snakes and spiders are also very basic fears that set in early in development.
Mm-hmm. He spoke about the tactile feeling, things that will touch you here too. That is something that will set people off. You're in the dark and something brushes against you.
Mm-hmm.
It's all hooked into a system that can react how quickly to a stimulus.
Well, within milliseconds, that system is multifaceted. So you have nervous signals that can occur in milliseconds on the scale of milliseconds, and also hormonal signals that take a little longer but can provide a more widespread, multifaceted response throughout your body. And what Ian has taken advantage of, and Halloween tends to be about in some ways, is the fact that there's overlap in how those nervous impulses and hormones trigger and activate different parts of our brain. Overlap meaning you get some activation of systems that have a certain kind of pleasure and reward associated with them. Why do people go to scary movies? Why do people go to Ian's place and pay money to go in there and get scared? It activates, parts of our brain that there's a reward value associated with that.
A reward not during it, but after, that you've, what the sense, I've survived this mortal threat?
Yeah, I think a little bit during and after. People seek out scary situations deliberately and pay money for movies and money for Ian's whorehouse.
Right. Kelsey Spaulding, get in here as a doctoral candidate studying fear at the University of Iowa in clinical psychology. Relate your work, perhaps, to Ian's work there in giving people a thrill, a fright. What are you doing specifically?
So I'm interested in fear generalization. So when we learn to be afraid of something, this often generalizes to things that remind us of the initial fearful event. So you can think of a soldier goes to war, he comes back, and now he might experience fear in the space of the sound of a firework or the sound of a car backfiring, something that reminds them of the fearful event.
Right.
So this process happens naturally in everyone, but it's exaggerated in fear disorders. But in a haunted house type of situation, you could use things that remind us of these fearful experiences to trigger the same kind of response and play on fear generalization in that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Since you're here, Kelsey, let me first start with Ian. Do you notice a difference in fear response at the slaughterhouse, Ian, a gender difference, male, female, and the degree to which they show fear, how they show fear?
Typically, the biggest difference you see is that men will typically show less fear on the onset. But as they get into the attraction and into the darker spaces, a lot of the times they respond a lot more than a female will.
Their mask drops, so to speak.
Yeah, it does in the dark. And along the same lines about the triggers of fear and that kind of sadomasochistic desire of the human, I think that, we're all connected by one extremely impactful event in our lives, childbirth itself. And I think that first very traumatic, as beautiful as it is as well, of course, that really traumatic, bloody event, that's our first connection to our breathing experience in life. And I think we want to reconnect with that from time to time. I think it's part of the reason why there is a pleasure in being scared.
Kelsey Spaulding, as a female brain scientist, do you keep up on the literature about the differences in the in fear between the genders?
So we know that there's a difference in between the genders and who's diagnosed with having a fear-related disorder or an anxiety disorder. And they tend to occur much more frequently in men – or, sorry, in women. So often 2-to-1, actually, in women. Mm. And so
– thoughts on why that is?
Well, it's thought that there is likely a biological component to why this would happen more frequently in women. But we also have to take into account that, as Ian was mentioning, women – sometimes express fear and anxiety more differently. So it's also possible that it's reported more frequently in women than in men. But with that sort of a discrepancy, it's likely there's also a biological component as well.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Trinnell, let's say I'm going to go to Ian's slaughterhouse. It's a first date. I'm a young guy. It's first date. I'm
bad
really
first date.
Bad first date. You'd say don't do it. You say right, Ian.
Yeah, it depends.
Let's say I'm really concerned about becoming too frightened and. Well, could lead to whatever, we know. Is there any way beforehand for me to inoculate myself, so to speak, to think certain thoughts, to get in a certain frame of mind so that when I walk in and Ian does his best for my $20, I can still have respect when I walk out?
Yeah, so I guess I can give the very extreme version of the preparation for that, Ben, which would be to go into the you could go into the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Iowa Clinics and ask them to perform a bilateral amygdalectomy and remove your amygdala on both sides. You have a left one and a right one.
That's more than $20.
That's more than $20, and it's not reversible, and so that it's not something everybody would do. But that would inoculate you extremely well, and we have lots of good science to support that. In fact, a field experiment on exactly this experiment. So.
Right, right. Talk a little bit more about that, because we talked on an earlier program. You analyzed over years, studied her for decades, a woman who actually felt no fear due to damage to her amygdala?
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And we did several years ago with a former student of mine, Justin Feinstein, who led this experiment. We took her through a haunted house. Ian may know of this. It's a place in Louisville that's reputed as the scariest one in the country or something to that effect, and led her through that place. And she went through that with no fear and leading the troops and going down dark hallway after dark hallway and being touched by monsters and et cetera, with no fear.
And you had sensors on her. You could see that it wasn't just an act. Her system was not responding as most people's do.
Correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. She quite the contrary. She enjoyed the experience and was wow. was leading the way. Yeah. So
maybe
so,
you'll get her coming in, Ian.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll do our best.
But there was, if I'm recalling your research with her, there was one thing that you could create fear in her with, and it's been mentioned already, breathing, right? You mentioned this, Ian, being born and gasping for air. Wasn't that what tripped her?
Well, I'm not sure Ian was quite referring to that, but...
No, what you're referring to in your research.
Yeah,
it was the breathing. That was something that...
In the research, so what we discovered, Ben, is that that breathing a high concentration of carbon dioxide, so 35%, which is about 850 times what's normally in the air, it causes the sense of strangulation or suffocation. And in this patient, our expectation going into this was that she would not have a fear response because we hadn't been able to scare her with anything, snakes, spiders, the haunted house, anything, for 20 years of trying. In this experiment, to our amazement, she actually panicked, had an exaggerated fear response, and panicked and literally sort of came unglued in the situation. And later, it became, as we tested this out in our experiments, it became apparent that the key difference was this stimulus is interoceptive, or coming through the body as opposed to coming from the outside world. And that fundamental difference is what led to a different response and used a pathway that bypasses the amygdala to activate her entire fear response.
Mm-hmm. We know our society has become coarser in many ways over the last few years, and also we have more and more horrific films. It seems we're getting desensitized here. You've been running, Ian, your first time out with the slaughterhouse was in 2010. In that short time, in those 7 years, have you noticed that people are harder to scare? Are they more desensitized than they were when you started?
I have to believe that they are, just from the level of graphics that are now created and are marketed. It's really hard to tell, though, because we do see thousands and thousands of patrons on a yearly basis. So it really comes down to viewing and witnessing the individual effects of the patrons. And we just do our best to make sure that every person, you know, gets their three startles before they before they leave the exit.
I could add a comment to that, Ben, if you want.
Yeah,
I think there's... I would agree with Ian, and I think there's been kind of a change in the kinds of stimuli that are required to trigger fear responses in people.
For instance?
Well, you know, we don't encounter bears, I mean, on a regular basis. And even spiders and snakes, which are so sort of hardwired, I mean, we don't encounter things like that nearly as much as, you know, our 100 years ago ancestors. A lot of the things that trigger fear now are social related and related to being in crowded spaces with a lot of other people, and have to do a lot with the density of people and the crowding in urban areas. And a lot of the phobias that we deal with as clinical psychologists are related much more to that than to, you know, fear of basic things like spiders and snakes and bears.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey Spaulding, your thoughts on how fear, perhaps desensitizing the society has been to our fears?
Yeah, I think I would agree with what Dr. Trunnell was saying in terms of you kind of see a shift in what people are coming in for and what they're reporting fears of.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see that with prevalence rates, that when you look at people reporting social phobia or social anxiety, that's really high. It's right up there next to specific phobias like spiders and snakes and things like that.
You know, if we took you, Kelsey, or you, Dr. Trunnell, or you, Ian, and we took you... Well, if we were in the 30s, I don't know, when did the original Frankenstein come out in the cinema with Boris Karloff, you know?
Yeah.
I have spoken with an older person, and they said, you know, when that came out, that was terrifying. But we see it. Younger eyes see it. Our eyes, any eyes almost, see it, and they think, silly.
Right.
Anything but frightening, right? So then, I don't know. That's desensitization, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot of that, and I think Ian, I mean, the challenge for somebody like Ian is to keep those places up to speed and with the times in terms of trying to scare. I wouldn't want to try to scare a teenager today with, I mean, what would you do to them?
Ian, are they harder to scare than older folk?
No, if you create the right environment and the correct lead up, then you can startle anyone. While we are, like, scaring is the word, but really what we're focused on is the startle. Many people will give in to their fear, and they will allow themselves to be immersed and be under that veil of, you know, the attraction itself. They'll let go. But it's really the individuals that won't that we focus on. So it's about creating those startle effects. It's about those really loud noises and bright lights in the darkest spaces in between the scenic environments, which are created just to immerse and completely encapsulate the mind of those that are both there for the visual aesthetics, those that don't really have that amygdala response, and those that are there to be completely immersed and maybe leave with a change of pants in mind.
A couple of quick questions before we leave for today. I imagine you have people on both ends of the spectrum, people who go through multiple times, Ian, right?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, well, okay. The other end of this, and I want a truthful answer here, even though it's Halloween. How many people, what percentage would you say walk out and say, I will never, ever in my life do that ever again or anything like it?
10%.
10%.
Okay, yep.
I was saying 5 or 10. I was thinking to myself that was about it. Okay, very good. Is there a future? Ian, do you see a time when we're so desensitized that you just throw up your hands and you say, can't do it anymore?
No, never. I think we, as attraction operators, as immersive entertainment producers, we will evolve along with our audience and we'll inherently know what it takes to to bring pleasure from what we're creating, and we might get to a time where fear isn't as much of an attraction as other emotions. Right now, for me, it is the season of horror, but that changes, okay. Come Valentine's Day.
Ian Miller, owner and operator of the Slaughterhouse and Haunted Attraction in Des Moines. Thanks for stepping into our studio, Ian.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
And Dr. Daniel Trunnell and Kelsey Spaulding of the University of Iowa. Thank you very much for sharing with us the science of fear.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Robbie Broad helped us out today as well. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.